From WHQR Public Media in Wilmington, North Carolina, this is Coastline. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn, and those are actual whale sounds courtesy of the Oceania Project, a research and conservation nonprofit out of Australia. Whales are the largest mammals on Earth. They've also been around a long time. According to UC Berkeley's evolutionary biology website, the first whales evolved over 50 million years ago from a terrestrial ancestor. Consider the human, thought to have first appeared in Africa about 300,000 years ago. Although whales and humans have shared the planet since humans popped up, it's striking how little we understand about these marine creatures. We do know their closest living relative is the hippopotamus, but researchers are just now studying how whales, who breathe air oxygen to survive, can dive as deeply as they do and stay submerged as long as they do. One of the ways they're learning about whale physiology is by studying their fat. Researchers are also newly able to extract data from a whale's baleen to learn about their ecosystem, feeding habits, and reproduction, even from whales who swam in the Earth's oceans as far back as the 19th century. With us today are two of these researchers. Allie Fleming is an adjunct research faculty member at the Center for Marine Science, part of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. Allie Fleming, welcome to Coastline.
Thank you so much, Rachel. It's great to be here.
Great to have you here. And Hillary Glandon is a postdoctoral research associate in the Department of Biology and Marine Biology at UNCW. Welcome to the program, Hillary Glandon.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Glad to have you here. And we're, of course, inviting you to join the conversation during the live Thursday discussion. What have you always wanted to know about whales? We already have a few questions that have popped up on Facebook. You can call us during the live edition at 910-343-1138. You can also email us today at coastline@whqr.org. Allie Fleming, how are whales changing their behavior in response to climate change?
That's a great question. There's a lot of different responses we're seeing today, but one of the first ways to answer that question is actually explaining a bit about how we know and what we're looking for. And there's kind of two elements. One is, how do we study whales and how do we make these observations to know what's happening? And then what are we seeing in terms of the responses? And so in terms of the first part of just how do we know what we know, how are we finding out new information, it's really taken us a long time to develop the technologies that allow us to investigate these amazing animals. Because, of course, we've always been drawn to them. Humans have a really long history, as you just mentioned, with whales especially and dolphins. But with the history of whaling, we've been interacting with these species for centuries. And despite that, and despite having them on our beaches and hunting them and even in the past eating them and using them for all sorts of products, we know very little. And so in recent decades, we've started to make technologies, either tags that we can put on the animal that stay with them when they dive or stay with them for months while they swim to far reaches of the ocean.
And we're going to dive more deeply into that, into those tools. But what are you seeing in terms of how they're changing their behavior?
Yeah, great. So we are seeing them sometimes shift their habitats. They're moving further in this hemisphere. They're moving further north, spending more time in those colder waters than we've seen, maybe changing what they're eating and when they're eating. Some are choosing not to migrate. We're seeing some populations have less babies and reproduce less in response to changes in their foraging and prey bases.
When you say that some are just choosing not to migrate, are you saying that they're staying in the northernmost regions?
That they might stay in the areas where they have food longer. So if they have enough food, some of the very migratory species would migrate thousands of miles to breed. But if they don't have enough food and they're not going to be fat enough and then they can't carry a baby, they might choose not to actually migrate that year. We're starting to be able to track if some of those individuals are making decisions like that based on their food reserves.
So you're talking about the waters are warming.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's affecting where they go or don't go.
Mm-hmm.
And you're also saying that the food population is diminishing in some areas?
Exactly. In some places it is, and in some places it's changing the species. So their favorite type of prey might be less available, and another species is becoming more dominant. And that might either be something that they don't like as much or is harder to catch, or might not have quite the sort of bang for your buck number of calories and benefits to the whales that they need in order to fatten up and make those journeys and carry a baby.
Are there parts of the globe that are seeing more of this change more rapidly than others? I mean, are we seeing that right off the North Carolina coast or along the eastern seaboard?
It's been studied more in the more extreme environments where we do see that change happening faster, like in Antarctica and in the Arctic, and yeah.
Hillary Glandon.
Yeah, so one species that we have fairly good documentation for a shift in distribution in response to a shift in prey base is the North Atlantic right whale. They're found along the east coast of the U.S. They're a highly endangered species, very few individuals left. And in recent years, the population is highly monitored. And in recent years, we've seen little to no calves being born. So it doesn't necessarily mean that there were zero, because as Allie said, you know, the ocean is large and we may not be able to see every single calf, but normally we observe some. And we know that right whales focus on a very specific life stage of one species of zooplankton to fatten up for reproduction. And so that prey base has shifted in its common feeding areas off Maine and New Brunswick and Nova Scotia.
When you say it shifted, it's moved or died off, or both, or do we not know?
Work in the lab that I work in at UNCW is Dr. Heather Koopman's lab, and we do a fair amount of research up in the Bay of Fundy, and they've been monitoring this species of zooplankton for at least 10 years. And we have seen that there are less of them in the summer in the Bay of Fundy. We suspect that they have moved a little bit north to the Gulf of St. Lawrence, which is just sort of on the other side of Nova Scotia. But the monitoring data in the Gulf of St. Lawrence hasn't been as extensive. So we're not exactly sure if the whole zooplankton population has shifted north, or if, but in that case, as Allie said, we've seen a replacement of this really desirable species with a much less desirable one that has less energy, is much smaller. And right whales, like many baleen whales, have baleen that is has evolved to effectively capture their favorite prey species. And so if you have a new species that is differently shaped or differently sized, it may not allow the animal to feed as well.
Are you seeing evidence of that in right whales?
I'm not exactly sure. We would think that would show up as low body condition or poor reproduction, and I'm not sure if we know that in right whales.
And so is there a theory right now? I understand that it's not conclusive whether this zooplankton has actually just moved or whether its population is diminishing, but do you know why this other lesser form of zooplankton would be taking up residence in that area? Is it a result of climate change?
Well, for most of the species, they've been there all the time. They just weren't the dominant species. So you think about competition in nature. And so if these larger, more energy-rich prey were there, not necessarily feeding on these smaller zooplankton, but just kind of taking up ecological space, if they've left, then there's more resources for these smaller species.
You mentioned the term baleen, which I also mentioned in the introduction, but not everybody knows what that is. Can you explain baleen, Allie Fleming?
Yeah, absolutely. So baleen is what some whales have in their mouth instead of teeth. So it's a filter feeding mechanism instead of a chewing mechanism, and it's made of keratin, which is the same material that our nails and hair are made out of and actually grows in a really similar way, that it continues to grow from just the roof of the mouth. They only have it at the top jaw, and it's these big pieces. And some species, it can be 3 meters long, 9-10 feet long. And they have many, many plates. They're called plates because they're these hard pieces that are kind of plastic feeling. And they hang down from the roof of the mouth, and they're like a big sieve or a rake that goes across the front of the mouth. And the animal will open its mouth very wide, taking an enormous gulp of water that also contains the prey, and then push the water back out through the baleen, and the prey gets stuck behind the baleen, and then they can swallow that. So it's a really efficient way of capturing food in an aquatic environment.
And Hillary, you said that baleen has evolved in different kinds of whales to adjust to the kinds of prey that they're looking for.
Right.
So what kinds of whales are we more likely to see, say, off the coast of North Carolina?
We have lots of whales off North Carolina. It's one of the reasons why there's so much whale research happening in North Carolina, because there's lots of species of whales. So we have humpback whales, which are very large baleen whales, minke whales. We have beaked whales, which are a very cool species that we're doing some work on in our lab, a group of species, I guess, that are very deep divers. We have also lots of dolphins.
And the right whales.
The right whales migrate along. So they spend the summertime up north, like Maine and New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, and then south near Florida and Georgia.
That's where they breed.
Right.
And we're going to come back to that. You're listening to Coastline. We're learning from two whale researchers today about the largest mammals on the planet. When we come back from this break, we'll hear from some listeners. You can reach us via email on this Thursday at coastline@whqr.org. You can also give us a call at 910-343-1138. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Allie Fleming is an adjunct research faculty member at the Center for Marine Science, part of the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. And Hillary Glandon is a postdoctoral research associate in the Department of Biology and Marine Biology at UNCW. They're both studying whales in different ways. And today, we're going to learn about new research tools coming into practice, elements of whale physiology that we haven't understood before, and what ecosystems for long-dead whales might have been like. You can ask your own question on this Thursday by calling us at 910-343-1138 or sending an email to coastline@whqr.org. Now, we've talked a little bit about North Atlantic right whales feeding on a certain kind of zooplankton way north of us, up in the Bay of Fundy, Hillary Glandon. But are whales generally that travel kind of along the eastern seaboard similar in terms of their migratory patterns and feeding habits, or is there this incredible spectrum?
I would say much more likely the latter. There's a huge spectrum of migration ranges and feeding types. So there's, you know, two main types of whales. Earlier we talked about baleen whales, and Allie explained really well how baleen works. And then there's also whales. So those whales are our really large whales. All the large whales that you think about, like a blue whale and a humpback whale, even though they're so big, they eat like teeny, teeny, tiny little prey. And the more medium size and small whales, they have teeth, and they're called odontocetes, and they focus on fish and eat fish or squid. Some of the deep divers eat squid. So they target different habitats, different depths, and have different, you know, ranges where they're kind of happy physiologically in terms of temperature. You know, whales are mammals. They're warm-blooded. So they do have an ability to regulate their body temperature. They're not like fish where their body temperature is essentially equal to that of the water. So they do have some flexibility in terms of the environment that they can be in. But like all creatures, there is a limit. And so if a species is supposed to be in cold water and the water gets too warm, it will reach a point where it can't handle that.
Allie.
And they have what we often refer to as different life histories. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of the way that they make a living in the ocean can be a really diverse suite of options. So as Hillary was just explaining, they have all these different adaptations, and different groups have different adaptations that allow them to do different things, which is why so many of them can exist in the same oceans and same area without all overlapping for the same resources and having a lot of competition. So the large whales are often highly migratory, will travel thousands of miles in a year between very cold areas and very warm areas for feeding and breeding. And others will focus, like the bottlenose dolphins that we see often right here off our beaches. They might stay very locally throughout the entire year and go even inland, up some of the inlets and rivers into areas where it's mixing of fresh and salt water. And so that's something really different than, obviously, we wouldn't see a baleen whale doing that. So they have lots of different ways that they can make a living in the ocean.
Yeah. And just before we went to break, Hillary, you were talking about all the different kinds of whales that might be seen by people off the North Carolina coast. Beth commented on Facebook. She wants to know about the migration patterns of whales in the area. Specifically, when is the best chance to see them off the North Carolina coast?
Well, that's a very good question. Thank you.
And a hard one?
It's a little tricky, right? Yeah. So the thing to remember about large whales is that they generally occur fairly far offshore. It's pretty rare to see a whale from the beach, right, or from a pier. You really need to go in a boat. You know, dolphins, for sure. I mean, people see dolphins, bottlenose dolphins, on the beach all the time. They can come in. They're a lot smaller. They can come in closer. So I'm not sure I would invest a whole lot of time, you know, standing on the beach looking for a whale. But North Carolina, we have some resident whales, and we have a lot of whales that migrate up and down the coast. And so that migratory season is really in the spring and then in the fall as they're kind of shifting from the warmer waters to the colder waters and then back.
Anne Pabst, a professor of biology and marine biology at UNCW, told us, and I know she's a colleague of yours, told us nearly 2 years ago, it was August of 2017, that one of the things that was really startling about the recent research is that right off our own coast, Cape Hatteras is the single site with the highest species diversity of cetaceans anywhere along the Atlantic coast and the coast of the Gulf of Mexico. What are we learning now? Since then, 2 years later, what have we learned about the biodiversity off, say, Cape Hatteras?
We work very closely with the Duke Marine Lab out in Beaufort, and they have a really comprehensive field program where they're doing a lot of monitoring of the whale and dolphin populations off our coast in Cape Hatteras. And if you think of, you know, the map of the East Coast, you know, Cape Hatteras, like where Wilmington is, you know, it sticks out a little bit, right? And so this geographic feature can cause mixing of water, and it's also a really good spot for prey. And so it's one of the reasons that we think that there's lots of different whale species here. And so the Duke Field Program has been doing a lot of monitoring of whales with tags, done a lot of biopsy work, and recently Dr. Pabst's lab and the folks at Duke have taken a many-month survey where they're doing visual and also acoustic surveys, because remember, whales echolocate. And so if you monitor the acoustics in the environment, you can identify if whales are there and often which species of whale, because they sound different, to try to learn distribution patterns and abundances of all these species. And so I think since then, we've really learned a lot.
So you talked a little bit about some of the ways that researchers are learning about whales. You've talked about tags. But Allie Fleming, what are some of the other tools that are out there now that weren't just a few years ago for whale researchers?
Yeah, some of the new advances are actually things that we do not out in the field, but back home in the labs. So we always need that marriage between the field work and collecting data in the field, whether that's a tag on an animal or collecting a small sample from an animal out in the field.
And then like a biopsy?
A biopsy, exactly. So a biopsy, just like we think of when we go to the doctor ourselves. And the way that we do that in the field, just really briefly, is we can take biopsies from live free-ranging animals by modifying either a crossbow or some
modifying
type of
a crossbow?
A crossbow, yeah. And instead of having a pointy tip at the end of that arrow, you have a hollow tip. Mm-hmm. And it's a little dart that will hit the animal. And it's very small. It's about the size of a pencil eraser or the end of my pinky finger. And for a large whale, that's small. That's probably something like a, you know, mosquito bite to us or something. They usually don't seem to notice at all, and it collects a small piece of their skin tissue. And then we can bring that skin tissue back into lab and freeze it, and it will last for decades and create 20, 30 more scientific research projects that can come from that one piece of small skin.
So is the arrow that you're shooting, the dart, is it attached to a string? How do you
either a
retrieve
string,
it?
Yeah, good question. Either a string or a flotation device of some sort, and then we go back and scoop it up with a little net or reel it in with the string.
And so how big is the sample that you might take?
Yeah, very small, only like sort of the last knuckle on your pinky finger probably. Okay. Is a good size estimate of that. And then we're developing new chemical and genetic and other methods for examining what compounds are in that skin. And that can tell us things about what they ate. It can tell us about their reproduction. It can tell us if they're stressed. It can tell us if they're in polluted waters. It can tell us if they just recently had a baby, how they're related to other whales and dolphins, how they're related to their same species. Are they a family? All of these kind of questions we can get from just this one little piece of skin.
How?
So with a whole suite of different analyses. So for things like I said, we want to know if they're stressed. So we can use hormones for that. And it's just recently, in the last maybe 10 or so years, that we're starting to figure out that we can use hormones to study whales. It's been a field that's been very well developed in human research and terrestrial mammal research. And now it's more recently been applied to whale research. And we have to learn all the basics first of do whales have the same hormones that we do? Do they have cycles in hormones? Are male and female hormones different? But then we can start getting into the really exciting questions of, did this whale just have a baby? Or did it get stressed and was it pregnant and then it did not have the baby after all? Or did it have a baby 3 years ago? Do they have babies every year? We can answer all these kind of questions.
How close are their hormones to human hormones? Is that question answered now?
We're starting to have more of the sort of characterizing of what their hormones are like, and we now know which hormones to target for certain questions, and we know which ones can tell us about stress due to a more immediate stressor like noise or some disturbance, or stress that's due to possibly more of a feeding stress, like if they're more starving response. And we know hormones that indicate that they're pregnant, or know hormones that indicate that they're getting ready for reproduction. And in the baleen samples, we can look over longer periods of time and look at questions of how many babies did they have over the last 10 years. So we know what the hormones are telling us a bit more now, so that we can start to answer some of those questions in detail.
So how do they reproduce? And I know that's a huge question when you're talking about all these different kinds of whales, but what have we learned, Hillary Glandon, about how often a female whale might have a calf?
Well, it's I think we know a fair amount about some species. Whale reproductive cycles vary on the order of one a year to one every, I don't know, multiple years. And so whales are mammals, and so they do spend, calves spend, they have a live birth, right? And then calves spend some time nursing with the mother, and so the mother and calf during that time are inseparable. And so that's when we sometimes see, pregnancy, birth, and that feeding time is a risky time for the calf and the mom. Because they're not, the mom isn't just thinking about herself. She has to take care of the calf and might not be able to avoid certain dangers because she's with a calf. And so I'm not super familiar about all the specifics of whale pregnancy cycles, but maybe Allie knows.
And
we know a lot about some parts of that question and nothing about other parts of that question. So as Hillary was just explaining, when the mom and calf are together, there's actually been a lot of studies on a few species in some parts of their life history. So humpback whales, for example, are one of the best studied large whales, and they've been really well studied in places like off of New England and in Hawaii. And in New England, that's a feeding area, and Hawaii is a breeding area. And so those two different areas, these are totally different populations. One is obviously in the Atlantic, one is in the Pacific, but they've given us lots of insight about, we know, like, yeah, that the mom and baby stay together for the whole first year of life, and they learn really important things during that year. They learn where to go to feed, how to feed cooperatively with other members of their same species, where the migratory destination is. They are similar to us in that they stay with mom and feed on milk for the first year, and so really cool things about their behavior. And then other pieces of the reproduction picture and cycle we know nothing about. Like, it's so rare that we see any mating event in the wild, and that's rarely ever been seen for any species. Even the best studied species have, I think, almost never been seen actually copulating in the wild. So we know nothing about that end of the private parts of whales' lives.
So many questions about that. But let me ask, what is the gestation period for a humpback whale?
It's about a year.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a year inside mom and then a year with mom.
Exactly.
Learning the ropes.
So it's a big investment, like humans too.
Yeah. Why are humpback whales the most studied?
They live really close to the shore. So as Hillary was saying, for a lot of the large whales, you know, you might not want to invest a lot of time on the beach looking for them because they do live far offshore. But humpback whales are sort of the most cosmopolitan of the large whales. They do come close into shore in some areas along the East Coast and West Coast. And they're very gregarious, and they spend a lot of time at the surface compared to some whales. They're quite acrobatic. They're the ones that often are, you know, make the best photos when you go on whale watches. They jump out of the ocean. That's called breaching, and they have these great big flippers that make lots of splashes. And so they're kind of fun and social and nearby.
You're listening to Coastline. Today we're exploring what researchers are learning about whales, what new tools they're using to study them, and we're going to find out how this understanding might be applied to the human experience. With us today, Hillary Glandon. She's a postdoctoral research associate in UNCW's Department of Biology and Marine Biology, and Allie Fleming, adjunct research faculty member at UNCW's Center for Marine Science. You can call us during the live discussion on this Thursday at 910-343-1138. You can also email us at coastline@whqr.org. Jan and Steve went to the same place, albeit separately, on our Facebook page. The new Prince of Wales, says Jan, and Steve wants to know more about their royalty. He says, I keep hearing about the Prince of Wales. Yes, everybody needs a good groan in the middle of the day. Andrea from Facebook says she wants to know about their songs. Has anyone found evidence of the difference between mating calls and food alerts? Hillary, Allie? They're arm wrestling over which one's going to take this question. So why don't we start with Hillary?
I think so. I am definitely not an expert on whale calls, but I am fairly certain that we do know the difference between mating calls and sort of food searching, more like social calls. And also we can tell, you know, calls of different types of species. They are different frequencies, different kind of patterns. And so humpbacks also are, as Allie was saying, quite gregarious in their songs. They're very vocal. And so that also makes them easier to study because we can monitor sound at their frequency in the water and hear them.
Allie Fleming.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And for some species, we do know the answers to those questions. And for instance, off the coast of California, there's been quite a lot of research on that with blue whales. Blue whales are one of the most historically hunted because they were the biggest. And so their numbers are still really struggling to come back in certain regions. And so acoustics have been a good way to study them because they're hard to see and hard to find. So you can leave longer-term recording instruments in the water and get a and get more information. And so we're starting to parse out feeding calls from breeding calls. And now with these new hormone techniques, we can start to add on these other layers and say, do we see this type of breeding call? And then does it happen to coincide with an elevated level of testosterone on that habitat at that time of year? Okay, that confirms for us that it's probably related to mating.
So you can also tell then when a whale is more stressed based on the hormone analysis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Can you tell a difference in the whale call if, you know, as Andrea asks, the whale is alerting maybe the calf or other whales to an oncoming ship or another environmental threat?
That's a good question. That would be a very short-term change in their stress level, so it kind of an immediate response, which we wouldn't be able to necessarily sample right in that moment and get the hormones and the stress levels. But from tag data, we might know at least a behavioral response as well as the acoustic. So the tags will be often a recording device, so we can listen to them at the same time as get the information from the tag that tells us, oh, they all of a sudden swam off in this other direction, or they all of a sudden stopped moving, or they all of a sudden swam very quickly or dove. And so those kind of behavioral responses, in addition to the acoustic recording, could tell you something about something to answer that question about a call and a stress call and then a stress response.
So you can do this hormone analysis and you can look at how often the whale may have bred.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've almost got historical data in your tissue sample.
Exactly, yeah. So some tissues. So with these biopsies that we talked about and the crossbow, that would be from modern contemporary whales that are in the ocean today. But we can explain more about how we do that with historical specimens and look at longer time series.
Yes.
After the break.
You did that so well. I think we could just go to break. You're listening to Coastline. It's a look at what we're learning about whales from two fascinating researchers out of UNCW. If you've always wondered about these giant marine mammals, call us on this Thursday at 910-343-1138 or send an email to coastline@whqr.org. When we come back, we'll have one more segment for you to get your question or comment in. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline. Listening to Coastline, I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn. Whales have been on the Earth for millions of years. Scientists say the marine mammals that we call whales actually evolved from land-based creatures, and the closest current relative is the hippopotamus. But there's so much we don't understand about whales, in part because they're not so easy to study. Today, Hilary Glandon, postdoctoral research associate in UNCW's Department of Biology and Marine Biology, is here, as well as Allie Fleming, an adjunct research faculty member at UNCW Center for Marine Science. You can ask your own question or make a comment on this Thursday by emailing us at coastline@whqr.org or calling us at 910-343-1138. It is the last segment, so just a few minutes left to get your question or comment in. And Allie Fleming, just before we went to break, I asked you about how you analyze the tissue samples or the biopsies that you take out in the field and the kinds of information that you can get from them. And you can see some kind of biography in that tissue sample. You were saying how often the whale might be giving birth or other things, but
yeah.
You can't tell if the whale has been stressed on a short-term basis.
Right, exactly. So different tissues can be used to tell us different parts of this biography. That's a great phrase. I'm going to have to use that in my scientific papers in the future. So the skin biopsies can tell us about recent events in the life history of the animal. So just like our own skin, it does come off. We have layers and it sheds. And so the skin biopsies will tell us about the last on the order of maybe a couple weeks or a few months of the life of the animal. And any of those kind of stress responses that we might be looking for have to be strong enough and long enough to have elevated in that tissue enough that we can then sample that in the lab. So if it was just the presence of a predator and then they ran off, we're probably not going to ever be able to see that, at least not today. Who knows, 20 years from now, what we'll come up with. But and then if the animal was pregnant, we would see that in the biopsies. But other types of tissues like baleen, like we talked about, or perhaps teeth or bone that are in the life of the animal, are in the animal the whole life, they can tell us longer histories and longer parts of that biography. So baleen wears down and will give us information over usually 3 to up to 25 years worth of data in the history of that one individual. And so if you're looking at a 25-year history, you get to see how many babies it had during that time, what were the intervals between those babies, so how frequently does it breed, did it ever have pregnancies that it started and then and didn't come to term, did it have other really stressful events in its life, like we can actually see the presence of an entanglement. So North Atlantic right whales that Hillary was mentioning before, they're so well studied that we often know the individual and everything about that individual, how many babies it had, who its mom was. Was it on the feeding grounds that year? Did it get hit by a ship? Did it get entangled? And then now researchers have put the pieces together and seen during the unfortunate event that one might strand or die from being hit by a ship or entanglement. They look back at the baleen of that individual and they can sample it for hormones and say, this individual... And they know the name, and then they'll know if it was
they
a male or female.
They have a name for the whales, so this is like ancestry DNA for whales.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. Yeah, yep. And so they know the whole family, sorted family history, and so they can look back and say this individual had 3 babies, and they know which babies those are, and they know which year, so that way they can match up to the baleen and say, oh, yep, that works. This method is telling us the right things. And then they'll see elevated stress levels when that animal was coming close to death, and if it was entangled, they'll see elevated stress levels. If it was sick, they see elevated stress levels. So we can start to really know a lot from these pieces of baleen over longer time periods and then more of the life history of that one individual.
And can you tell the illness that the whale might have suffered from the baleen?
Often with the example like the North Atlantic right whales, they know that that individual is entangled. They probably even try to disentangle it at some point. And so they'll know, oh, they first saw it entangled in March 2015, and then they can look in the baleen and see that the elevated stress levels would coincide with that date. And so they can learn, they do essentially an autopsy on the animal when it dies, and they can look and put those pieces together and figure out what happened. Not always what disease, but if it had a harmful algal bloom, like something from a neurotoxin or something like that, they might be able to tell from the autopsy, which for whales and dolphins is called a necropsy.
Okay. And I do want to find out what we know about the oceans, the ecosystem that the whales lived in the 19th century from the baleen. But first, we have to find out, Hillary Glandon, you're studying these deep diving whales, and you're studying how mammals are able to go as deep as they go and stay submerged for as long as they do. How similar are they to humans in terms of their physiological response to those depths?
Right, yeah, that's a really good question. Yeah, so the study I'm working on is focusing on a group of deep divers called beaked whales. So they're odontocetes, they eat squid. We think maybe some fish, but mostly squid, and they dive routinely to depths of about a mile or more, if you think about that, for at least an hour. Recorded times of dives have been over 2 hours in some of these species.
And these are air-breathing mammals.
Air-breathing mammals, right. And it's not unusual. This is their typical day. They're, you know, breathing at the surface for a short interval, just a few minutes, and then they spend some time going down, and they hang out at depth and feed and do, we don't really know what else, and they'll come back up, and they're kind of like robots, right? It's sort of, if you think about it, kind of a boring way to live. Like, you're just going up and down all the time. Like, you know, they're not like humpback whales where they're playing around and breaching and doing, you know, they're just like up and down, kind of like whale robots. And so, but it's really amazing because they breathe air. And so we know that there's this suite of physiological responses called the dive response. And so this happens when any air-breathing mammal is submerged in water. It would happen, you know, on a less grand scale to a person, where you have your heart rate drops and, you know, your blood vessels in your hands and feet might constrict and blood might get shunted from your extremities to the middle of your body. And so, you know, that happens like in your intro physiology lab in college. You would probably test that on a person. You can put your face in the water and measure that stuff. But whales have additional sort of adaptations that help them to essentially be really efficient at storing the oxygen that they get when they're at the surface so that they can, quote unquote, hold their breath for a really long time. So they'll have higher blood volume. So blood is what stores oxygen, right? They'll also have higher levels of those oxygen storing molecules in your body, like hemoglobin and myoglobin and hematocrit. Those are all elevated in these really deep divers. And they, some of them have this really complex rectal system, which is like these sort of extra blood vessels in their thorax that helps them to store this oxygen so they can dive for a really long time. And so the project I'm working on is interested in trying to understand if there's any specific adaptations in the central nervous system of these really deep divers, because your central nervous system is obviously quite critical to survival. And but there's a lot of fat or lipid in the central nervous system. And that's because myelin, which is what conducts nerve signals, that's what, you know, get things from your brain to the rest of your body, is made primarily of lipid. And so it's also really good at sucking up gas. And so when these animals dive super deep, they're exposed to really high pressures of gas. And so we were interested in trying to understand, are there specialized adaptations of the brain and spinal cord in these deep divers that might allow them to, these tissues, to be exposed to this really high gas pressure and still function quite normally. So I've been working on this project for almost 2 years, and so far it seems like the spinal cord and brain of deep diving whales is just the same as that of shallow diving whale, just the same as that of a human, a pig. So the fats in there are no different, and they're not found in different proportions, which is, you know, sometimes in science we always want to find this really big difference, but actually this is almost more remarkable that they're so similar, because you think about what they're exposed to, these deep divers, compared to, you know, a pig or a person or a bottlenose dolphin. And so the next step of this grant is to try to look a little bit deeper and to see, are there other adaptations in the central nervous system that may allow for this function to happen in the face of the high pressure.
And the Office of Naval Research, is it? Is interested in you figuring this out so that they can apply it to humans.
Yeah, so
for their own purposes.
Yeah, this project, as Dr. Koopman has a grant from the Office of Naval Research. Really, it's their human diving division. So ONR does fund research on, have a whole marine mammal arm, but we're not really currently funded by that. And yeah, they're interested in just what the physiology of these deep divers can maybe tell us to help protect their human divers and also their Navy officers that are in submarines, because they're also exposed to high pressure. And it's a great program to be a part of. It's really interesting, and there's a lot of really great research coming out of that specific ONR arm. It's really great.
We had a call. Kim from Oak Island was asking about how whales are affected by seismic blasting and offshore drilling. And it was this same discussion 2 years ago in August that your colleague Ann Pabst was on with marine scientist Doug Novacek, who studied this as well. And it was around the time that Dr. McCauley out of Australia and his colleagues found that just about a little more than a kilometer away from a relatively small air gun array, they found an increase in the mortality rate of zooplankton by 200 to 300%, and that was a shocking number to researchers at the time. So what does that mean then? Because there are two questions here, I guess. What does that mean if the zooplankton population, which is what a lot of whales feed on, is so deeply affected? And then how does the seismic blasting affect the whales in terms of communication and reproduction and all the rest of it?
This has been a very hot topic for research. The grant that we have now isn't really directly investigating, sonar and whale strandings and whale sort of behavior, but lots of people have. We know that there is a correlation between mid-frequency sonar and in the environment and stranding, specifically of beaked whales. Like, it's been documented in multiple places throughout the world, and a review paper just came out about it in 2019, just this year, sort of summarizing. There was a workshop in the Canary Islands, and a bunch of these researchers, including Dr. Pabst and Dr. Koopman, were there. But we really do not understand the mechanism of why this sonar testing is causing these strandings. Some people have hypotheses, but we've sort of just been able to put together the pieces definitively to say, okay, we see this pretty direct correlation, but we're not.
So you don't know why, but you know it's correlated.
Right.
The seismic blasting with the whale strandings, specifically beaked whale strandings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Robert asked, do we know how changes in ocean oxygen levels and acidity due to climate change may be affecting whales and other marine mammals beyond changes in the balance of the food resources and their habitats?
Beyond the food resources.
All right, yeah.
Well, we do see that some of the marine mammals are shifting their distribution geographically, and we think a lot of that has to do with where their food resources are and how abundant they are. But I feel like the more we look at their physiology, we often start learning about certain limitations that they have or preferences for specific conditions in terms of temperature and oxygen and the cleanliness or turbidity of the water and pollutant levels and these kind of things. So we have often started with those sort of first order questions about what about what they eat. That's probably the first thing that we sort of think to look at, and that's one of the main drivers of why whales are where they are. But the more specific we get into their physiology, mm-hmm. we often start finding out more, right?
Yeah, I mean, water oxygen levels, it's a little tricky when you think about marine mammals because they breathe air, right? They're not obtaining their oxygen directly from the water. But in many cases, lowered oxygen levels occur at the same time as high temperatures. Mm-hmm. And so that could affect, distribution, like Ali said.
We do need to find out quickly. We're running out of time, but what were the oceans like in the 19th century? And you've learned about this from the old baleen from museums that you've studied.
How different were they? Yeah, well, we think what I'm finding, and this is new, and there's not that many people doing it, so we don't know really definitive answers to these questions, but it is very cool that we can use these old pieces in museums and start to look at different chemical compounds. I'm using something that's called stable isotope analysis, and we can look at how the ecosystems were structured and what the base of the food web was like at that time and what the nutrient levels were like.
What was the base of the food web?
It was probably a little bit different from today, and it might have had higher levels of nitrogen in some of the waters where I've been looking, and part of that might actually be because of the presence of more whales at that time. That's my working theory at the moment, is not yet confirmed, but ecosystems are a really delicate puzzle, and the more that we take pieces out, the more things shift. And what I am finding so far from my samples is that it looks like actually the whales, just by being there, were influencing the very base of the food web, because they changed the transport and regeneration and movement of nutrients, even not just their large bodies, but even small compounds in the ocean are influenced by them.
And that's this edition of Coastline. We're going to have to continue this conversation. Hilary Glandon, Ali Fleming, thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Coastline's producer is Caitlin Freund. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Production manager is Caitlin Hanrahan. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. And thank you, Bubbles from Australia. If you missed part of this episode, look for it at whqr.org. Get the podcast, find it on the HQR app, or just tune in for the rebroadcast Sunday afternoon at 3. I'm Rachel Lewis-Hilburn for Coastline.